failed the background check. "You know how it is," he said. Herman said, "You want to see something really interesting?" When you're alone with a man and he asks you if you want to see something interesting, it's reasonable to worry that he's talking about his penis. Men think their penises are much more interesting than they actually are. As soon as Adam discovered his erection, the world was doomed. He tried to put it inside Eve, and even though she wasn't sure, she let him, because it seemed easier that way. And then he was so proud of himself, like he'd invented something. All he wanted was admiration for his erection, and when he didn't get it, he lashed out. I told Herman I was fine, not seeing something interesting. "Come on," he said. He put his arm on my shoulder, leading me toward the bed. I decided then that I would murder him if he pushed me onto the bed or his hand moved anywhere else besides exactly where it was. I would blame it on the psychic energy of the room. He leaned down and lifted up the mattress. There were 5 DVDs beneath it. "He kept porn in here." Herman laughed. "Kid had decent taste." The only thing I wanted in the world was to not have a conversation about contraband porn with Herman. "Kids have it easier now," he said. "I had to go out in the woods where my friends hid a Playboy under a rock. We had to steal it from my friend's grandpa, who kept it in a box with all this old World War II stuff. Nowadays, they can get whatever they want online." He quietly contemplated the lost directions of his youth. To get whatever you want, whenever you want, is a luxury of the future. You want things and you get them, and then you feel sick of them, and then you want to die. Herman wanted to show me one more thing, in the closet. The boy had owned many stuffed animals, all of which had been crammed into a box. I imagined the boy waking up on the morning he was going to die, and opening his closet to dig out his clothes for the day. He knew what he was going to wear, had planned it for months. He stepped into his camouflage pants and checked to make sure the cargo pockets were still packed with ammo. He'd stashed a backpack full of homemade explosives in the back of the closet. After he strapped it on, he leaned forward and saw the container filled with his animals. I imagined him picking up the stuffed elephant. The elephant's name was Spout. It was written on the tag. And pressing his lips together to make a sound like an elephant's trumpeting. Spout had been his favorite toy for years, even after he was old enough to have outgrown stuffed animals, and I could see the areas where his exterior was faded and worn by years of play. He'd put these animals away reluctantly. Until recently, they had been scattered across his bed, had lain with him when he was sick with the flu, had comforted him as he tried to fall asleep, despite the tsunami of rage in his head. But he'd gotten older, and there was always the possibility of a girl coming to his room. And also, he felt self-conscious, sitting at his computer with his back to them, while he researched the most efficient means of killing large groups of people. He still checked on them most mornings, still grabbed their little arms and made them wave to him, still rearranged them in their box to make them more comfortable. As he practiced deep breathing exercises in his room, mentally preparing himself to become a martyr, he realized he wouldn't miss his mother, or his computer, or his pornography, or his few friends. But he would miss Spout and Stella and Gus and the dozens of others he had loved more than he'd ever loved any person. He pushed them deeper into the box and tried to fold the flap shut, as if to hide them from hearing the news. But also, he knew they would notice when he never returned, and they would not be donated to needy children or used in any good way, because they would be viewed, like everything in this room, as tainted, as relics of an evil person. "No, look behind the box," Herman said. "Behind it." On the floor behind the boxes was a cache of liquor bottles. He must have had $500 worth of booze in here. I didn't understand why it hadn't been confiscated. Herman said he took a couple drinks each day to keep himself loose. He took a swig straight from a plastic bottle of vodka before offering it to me. Just that morning, I'd promised myself I would go a day without drinking. I wanted to be clear-headed. I wanted to wake up one morning that week and feel good about myself. But it was there, and he was relentless. And so I sipped it, my lips on the same bottle from which the boy himself had drunk. I felt the boy then in my blood. I felt him working through my veins. I took another sip. The boy was taking up residence inside my body, so that I could feel how alone and terrified and violated he'd felt. For a moment, I was an archangel on a path of divine vengeance, and all I wanted was to see something burn. I held a flaming sword in my hands and pictured it, cutting through the hearts of my enemies. I thought I should force myself to vomit and run out of this house so that he wouldn't be inside me any longer. My head was light, and my mouth was tingling, and I wanted more of that feeling. Herman and I continued drinking, standing the whole time in front of the bed. The boy inside both of us, his rage and fear inside both of us. The boys are victims, too. They're taught to act a certain way, and that the one means to being a man is to prove themselves through bloodshed. They're exposed to the Old Testament first, and they never forget that even God will kill his people over petty slights. They are handed 1,000 problems and only one solution, and then they are told to figure it out on their own. The next morning, or maybe it was several mornings later, I woke up in my bed, and I found myself clutching the guest book from the boys' home. H. Renfro and family from Charleston had visited, and they wrote, "Chilling." L. Riggs from Ontario said, "Great sight." P. Logan from Indianapolis said, "Makes you think." Calvin got in the habit of just texting me 3 question marks when he was worried about me. Every few days, question mark, question mark, question mark, would show up on my phone. This time I had to decide how to tell him I wasn't going to go to his house for Christmas. I'd never had Christmas dinner with his family before. I didn't know their traditions. I was afraid that spending even one day with Harlan and Colleen would make me love them in the same way I loved my brother. My mother's distance had taught me that it's better to love people from afar. Calvin would be disappointed. He was always disappointed. My job was to dial 10 numbers, listen to the ringing, and when my brother answered, to say, "Merry Christmas, Calvin." My job on Christmas was to call him and to talk to him for exactly 1/2 of 1 hour, to ask about his children and his wife, to ask how work was going, to see if he was looking forward to the upcoming year, to reassure him I was doing well, and then tell him a lie about how I was going to be spending the day with friends. Instead of calling, I manufactured chores to keep myself distracted. I took long drives to outlet malls to buy items I didn't need. I fucked Robbie ferociously until he asked me to stop. I cultivated an abiding interest in maintaining the cleanliness of my windows. I removed 1/2 the wallpaper in my bathroom. December is a time for observing traditions, even if you don't believe in them. It doesn't make sense to bring a dead tree into your house and cover it in very hot lights, but we do it anyway. It's important to be close to your family, even when you're not close to them. Even that year, I had put the old decorations out, without even thinking. The snowmen and the Santas and the candy canes all over my walls, on my shelves. I was being festive. I was filling myself with the Christmas spirit. I was trying. Every resident of Seldom Falls was required to sign up for an emergency alert registry. We gave them our phone numbers and email addresses, and they said they wouldn't use that information to track us. But I knew they would be tracking us. They sent a text message and an email anytime there was an emergency. And in the case of what they called an extreme danger event, they called us too. The first weekend, they tested the system 3 times. And each time the phone buzzed, I panicked and felt my stomach folding in on itself. I received messages every few days about a robbery a few miles away, or a stolen car, or a break-in. I had never thought of these issues as town-wide emergencies before, but now I felt beset by crime. I began seeing my neighbors not as people, but as either victims or perpetrators. At first, I thought I wanted to know about every danger around me, but I found myself paralyzed by it. There was an option to unsubscribe from the alerts, but what if the next one was about an extreme danger event? What if Godzilla came to town, and I was the only one who didn't know? A few years into my teaching career, during a school assembly near the end of the semester, I was called on stage by the entertainer, who was a magician. There was a spotlight on me and people chanting my name. There was too much pressure for me not to go along with it. I took the long walk to the stage, past guffawing children who, I realized at that moment, hated me and wanted to see me humiliated. I tried to be a good sport. I did that raise-the-roof motion people used to do, even as my hands were moving. I realized this made me look like I was ancient. When you're on stage, you become suddenly very conscious of the placement of your hands. As I held them primly against my side, I wished I'd never had hands, that I'd been born armless and legless and torsoless. The magician made me sit in a chair in the middle of the stage. He put his hand on my face, and I felt all the cells on that side of my body straining to break free. He asked if I'd ever been hypnotized before. He went through the preamble about how I would get sleepy and so on. And as I was thinking about how much I wanted to escape, I did find myself getting sleepy. I left my body and ceded control of it to him. I was still mentally there, but in a cage inside my brain. I could see everything happening, but I couldn't do anything about it. He made me stand and jump and do push-ups and hide under a table, as if an atom bomb was about to fall. He made me squeal like a pig and roll around and pretend mud and kiss the principal on the mouth. He said, "When I snap my fingers, you will tell us one very private secret." I couldn't stop myself from announcing that through college, I had worked as a phone sex operator to make extra cash. The response was deafening. I would rather have died. I'm not embarrassed to have worked phone sex lines. The men who called me were lonely. They wanted someone to pretend to like them. I needed money, and I was good at making myself into the woman they wanted. I have done much more degrading things for money, like waiting tables. But when strangers hear about what I did, they provide the shame for me. They do an impression of the breathy phone sex voice. They ask questions about the weirdest conversations I've ever heard. They think about my mouth forming filthy words to help a stranger get off. And their perception of me changes. As a teacher in a high school, there is no worse information to give away to herds of boys who are obsessed with their penises. They suddenly see you as attainable and forget that you are a person. The girls see you as pitiful, as a cautionary tale. Since the hypnotism, I have been 2 people, one who does things she cannot control, and one who hates the other person. My online therapist told me I was displacing blame. Robbie said this was the kind of drama he couldn't handle. He said it would be easier if I just accepted responsibility for my actions. Robbie suggested a vacation. It had been a very bad year, and he thought it would be good for both of us to end it with something nice, to treat ourselves. But the thought of getting on a plane made me ill. During these troubled times, I said, trying to sound as rational as possible, does it really strike you as sensible for us to get on a plane, to be surrounded by strangers in the air? Imagine it. Robbie reminded me that we had once gone to a Caribbean resort together, the first time we'd been dating. He reminded me how the most difficult decision every day had been which drink to order with breakfast, how we'd spent hours by the pool and then had lazy, drunken sex all night. I remembered a version of myself having done such a thing, but couldn't believe it had been me. To be in a plane? It felt like a death sentence. My online therapist said I needed to be willing to compromise, so I agreed to drive with Robbie to Ohio for a long weekend. We were going to stay at a bed and breakfast and get away from it all. Adults go on weekend getaways all the time. It's a normal thing normal people do. About 30 hours outside of Seldom Falls, we saw the sun again, cutting through a thick blanket of clouds. To feel it on my skin again, to feel enveloped by it, made me feel human. I lowered the window and stretched both my arms outside. I wanted to climb up onto the roof and strip naked and cover myself in sunlight. Robbie drove erratically because he couldn't stop fiddling with the radio. Nobody noticed because that's how everyone else was driving. From the passenger seat on the highway, you can see that nobody is looking at the road. They are all looking at their phones. Cars are too easy to drive, I said. It should be harder to use something that can kill you. Huh? Nothing. Robbie sighed. Christ, come on, just tell me, he said. The car slowed as he stared at me. Don't get mad just because I don't hear every single thing you say. It wasn't important. You mutter. You know, you mutter and you grind your teeth. I don't want to talk about my teeth. I turned the radio up. Robbie asked me to open the glove compartment. Inside, there was a pile of napkins, a Bible, and a brown lunch bag. Check the bag, he said. He looked very proud of himself. The bag contained two smaller baggies, one containing pot, and the other a number of unmarked pills. Don't I feel like a princess, I said. A lunch bag full of loose drugs. Why do you make it so hard to do something nice for you? I guess I'm just difficult, I said, shoving the bag back into the glove compartment. I thought it would be fun, get a little crazy. So you filled my car with drugs and drove it across state lines. He honked the horn and held it in. You can't honk at someone who's inside the car, I said. He honked again. Could you just... He paused to check the directions on his phone. Could you just cooperate on something? It's exhausting trying to manage you. Women are supposed to be fluffy clouds that glide through men's lives when it's convenient for them. So, fine. I reached into the bag and swallowed two of the pills and waited to see what would happen. The innkeeper was an older man who kept referring to his wife as my bride, and who had the unpleasant habit of addressing us as kids. Kids, follow me, he said. My face tingled like a limb regaining feeling, and my tongue felt like a dead thing lying inside my mouth. Robbie didn't know exactly what pills I'd taken. A friend had given them to him with the promise that we would have a lot of fun. Robbie and the innkeeper spoke to each other. I registered their voices, but as soon as the words entered my ears, they splintered and sent disconnected letters spiraling through my brain. I could see all the letters piling up in the landfill of my mind, and I imagined my other self standing there, her hand thrust deep into my skull, sorting through like an archaeologist and trying to make sense of everything inside. Robbie led me away from the conversation, and then we were in the room. My right arm was glued to my side. My hair felt hot. I was trying to be fun. I was trying to be flirty. I wasn't opposed to being these things. During the 4 days in the B&B, we spent a lot of time in the room, where there was a large soaking tub and a fireplace. We took pills and smoked pot and drank a bottle of wine a day. We sat naked in the tub for hours. When Robbie was asleep, I read the old guest books. One woman wrote that she'd taken her husband here for their 50th anniversary. "I believe this day saved our marriage," she said. "Ever since the kids, we've never had time to ourselves, and your beautiful home brought back the man I loved." 50 years of marriage seemed beyond impossible, almost selfish. To even live 50 years was a miracle. What would I have done if I'd lived in a home with two happily married parents who stayed together for 50 years and told cute stories about their courtship? Would other people like that now invite me to their house on weekends for lunch and fill me in on their neighborhood gossip? Would I volunteer at town meetings to organize festivals and craft fairs? The guest book was filled with liars. I crossed out their notes and changed them to make them more truthful. I changed one couple's note to say, "I just came here to have sex in a new bed." Another I changed to, "At night, I pretend I'm a whale, separated from my pod and lost on land, trying to blend in with the humans and surviving just barely. And while I'm here in this room, I can stop pretending and just lie in the bathtub and believe I'm at home with my family." Breakfast was served in a community seating arrangement. "Like the Europeans," the innkeeper said. He placed his hand on my shoulder while he spoke. I was desperately thirsty and drank 3 glasses of water before he gave me my own pitcher. The 3 other couples at the table were all married. Dull conversation assaulted me from all angles. I said very little. Where do people get stories? Do they go out in the world looking for interesting anecdotes? When they get home, do they write these things down and rehearse them? "You two are still so young," one man said. His hair was thick and shiny and had a natural curl that many women would kill for. The spots on his hands showed his age, but he was still one of the handsomest men I'd ever met. He had a voice like a news anchor. He said he did government work. "Wait till you get to our age," he said, and all the other couples laughed for some reason. There is nothing old people enjoy more than telling younger people exactly how old they are. I ate eggs and bacon and drank water and eventually left mid-conversation. The last thing we did in Ohio was visit a psychic named Madame Cordova. Everything in the room was white. Carpet, walls, couch, pillows. A puffy little dog she said was from Siberia and descended from Lenin's dogs. She told us to close our eyes and then held our hands. She made the kinds of spirit-summoning noises psychics make. Energy hummed through my arms. It was hard to keep my eyes closed, but sometimes it feels good to follow orders. She abruptly pulled away from us. "I've seen all I need to see," she said, and walked out of the room. We waited 10 minutes, assuming she would come back with some information, or a potion or something. But she didn't. At a rest stop, I stood at the bathroom sink, studying the posters on the walls warning travelers to be on the lookout for human trafficking. "Watch for the signs," they said. But they didn't say what the signs were. I tried to determine whether I looked like I had been trafficked. Was I showing the signs? Were the other women here of their own volition? Before looking at the poster, I hadn't considered the possibility that I was surrounded by sex slaves. On the highway, you can run into more dangers than you've ever imagined. Not just distracted drivers, but stalkers, sex traffickers, teens throwing rocks through windshields from the overpass. If you pass enough cars, you will have passed at least one murderer. That's just statistics. The day our vacation ended, I returned to the mysterious confession booth outside Murphy's Law. I waited my turn in line at the booth, and I sat down, and then I unloaded my sins. I told the story of the time I was supposed to feed my vacationing neighbor's cat and clean the litter box, but instead I just let it out in the backyard. And later I told the neighbors someone must have broken in and stolen it. I said I hadn't paid any bills on time in years. I recited all the daily chores I'd left undone. Everyone else seemed so organized and well-prepared, and I felt like I was always scrambling to catch up. I said I was lazy and unfocused, and I understood why I was unlovable, but I still wished it weren't so. Then I said sometimes at night, I think maybe I'm actually the one who did the shooting. I felt I was responsible somehow. My confessor asked if I'd called my brother yet. I didn't call him until New Year's Eve. I told him I was sorry I hadn't made it to his place for Christmas. "What are you avoiding?" he said. "Did I do something?" "It's just busy around here. I have a busy life." "Here's the deal. If you can't come here, I'm coming to you. Dr. Falk says I need to strengthen my bonds." The last time my brother and I had been together in Seldom Falls, I was testifying on his behalf as a character witness for the parole board. I didn't know how to stop him from coming back this time. January. Since September, the high school students had been redistributed to other schools in the area, but nobody was happy with that solution. They'd been randomly assigned to their temporary schools, so friendships were fractured, and relationships ended. Sometimes the only thing keeping two people together is scheduling. The staff at the new schools complained that our students were disciplinary problems. They said these students weren't temperamentally suited to their new environments, and also they were a burden on their curriculum. Our teachers and staff were out of work, and the township had only agreed to pay them for emergency leave for 1 month. School psychologists said the worst possible way to handle the situation was to displace the students and subject them to even more upheaval. But there was the problem of the bodies and blood and the bullets. It takes a long time to scrub a massacre site, and you can only do that after all the evidence is collected. The cleanup had ended a week before Christmas. All the holes had been patched and the walls repainted and the floors, buckled by water damage, were replaced. Everyone was desperate to get back to normal. But normal doesn't exist. You develop nostalgia, first for your youth, then for a fictional time that looks like your youth, but was never real. Before the shooting, I hadn't even known who my government representatives were. I was not a voter. I considered myself intelligent, but also busy. I was just informed enough to feel like there was no point in participating, to invite the betrayal of politicians who were not even human. They were excellent at replicating human emotion, but not at understanding how real people felt or behaved. In the months after the school shooting, the state senator from my district had built himself into a national figure. Every murder is an opportunity for someone else to succeed. He said his divine mission was to protect our state's children. He made regular TV appearances, promising to solve the murder problem once and for all. Most other state officials remained silent. They learned a long time ago that the best way to stay in power is to remind people you even have power, only when it's absolutely necessary. True leadership is never having an opinion on anything, because opinions might upset people. The state senator pushed to eliminate the restrictions on concealed carrying on school grounds. He said it would be dangerously negligent for the teachers to return to work unarmed. On the legislator floor, he stood silently beside posters of the victims, their smiling faces. On the bottom of the images was white text, hashtag never again. A week before the school reopened, they enacted a new policy. Every teacher and administrator would be required to keep a gun at their desk, like blackjack dealers in the Old West. And in each grade, 10 students would be designated as class guardians, armed and trained in tactical shooting. "Criminals will always have guns," the state senator said. "It's up to us to outnumber them with our own guns." Given the option, he probably would have installed cannons at the entrance. He probably would have torn down the building and replaced it with a giant gun. He would have lived inside the barrel of a gun and fired himself into the chest of suspects. Our state senator had partnered with the previous president and three of the world's five largest corporations to form an anti-violence task force. "As of this day," our state senator said, "we are declaring an all-out war on violence." The front lines of the war on violence were in commercials and in sponsored content on websites. There was a hotline to call. There were bumper stickers. There were many speeches. I watched videos of well-dressed, handsome men on daises talking about their hatred of violence, and I wondered how many had had dreams of driving a knife into the belly of their neighbor. How many had tried to run a car off the road because they'd been cut off? How many were sitting there quietly and scanning the crowd, looking for the woman they most wanted to fuck? Angie Sparks and Reverend Chet were in my house. They wanted to know why I hadn't purchased the guns I'd promised to purchase. I told them I didn't think I was cut out for the apocalypse. I was sorry for having made a promise I knew I couldn't keep. In the infinite possible timelines in which I exist, no version of me would be capable of standing up to the four horsemen when they arrived. Reverend Chet paced in circles. "This is a grave disappointment," he said. "I was under the impression that you were ready to be saved." Angie shook her head at me. She followed Chet around the room. "I thought we'd found a kindred spirit. I thought you understood that your soul is on the line. The expiration date is coming soon," he said. He raised his voice. "Doomsday is imminent, and you can't be bothered to help us." They'd been nice to me, at least until they tried to pressure me into buying guns I didn't want. But a brief period of niceness before the cruelty is the best you can ask for from some people. "I'm sorry, I can't help you," I said, and I'd meant it. I wanted very badly to be able to fully immerse myself in a group like this. They had such a clear sense of purpose. Angie glared at me. "I tried to save you," she said, "and you wasted my time." As the anniversary of the shooting approached, progress on the memorial had stalled. Construction had been delayed, restarted, and delayed again. No one could agree on what the memorial should look like, who should be honored, or where it should be placed. Death doesn't belong to the dead. It belongs to the people it leaves behind. Memorials are vanity projects anyway. They are slabs of stone painstakingly crafted into slightly different slabs. They are created at the height of despair, and then later regretted, then forgotten. The first time I ran away from home, I was only gone for 12 hours, and I spent most of my time in the woods behind the high school. I uncovered a granite slab the size of a large shoebox. It was a memorial to local veterans of the Spanish-American War. 17 names were carved into it. I found a man with my last name and traced my finger over the letters, trying to have a meaningful moment with it, this discovery of a perhaps long-lost relative named Earl. But Earl Crawford was an abstraction. no matter how concrete they tried to make him. The war itself was an abstraction. Memorials mean less with each day that passes. 2 decades from now, the freshmen in this school will see the shooting memorial and think nothing of it. They will lean against it while they sneak cigarettes. Someone will have sex on it. The urgency will be gone. You can't force people to remember. By then, 100 more schools will have been shot up. Everyone wants to remember forever. But the only healthy thing to do is to forget. At the site of every mass shooting, they were racing to build their own memorials. They felt obligated to commemorate the worst moment in their town's history. It was supposed to be about healing. It was supposed to be about remembering. But no matter how much time and money these cities spent on the design, they all came up with the same ideas. Plaques and flower gardens and small sculptures engraved with an inspirational quote. Candles and places for sitting and reflecting. Water features. The names of the victims printed on bricks. Everything was very tasteful and safe and simple. Each memorial represented a collective commitment not to remembering, but to whitewashing the memories, to creating a more palatable version of the memory for ourselves to hold on to, and repeat, and eventually accept as the truth. The memorials were there to hide failures, not to be critical of them. Every memory is false, and with each subsequent remembering, it becomes even more false. On a telephone pole near my house, I saw a flyer asking for volunteers for a neighborhood watch group called the Peacekeepers. Telephone poles suspend millions of miles of wires across the country, but sometimes the easiest way to communicate is just to staple a piece of paper to the pole itself. Later, I would email Norm, the organizer, and my message would travel through who knows how many miles of underground cables. Most of the structures that support our daily lives are invisible. I'd come to rely on so many things I could never describe, but whose absence I would feel deeply if they were taken away. I was the only volunteer to show up for the first meeting of the Peacekeepers. We met in Norm's garage, where he maintained a fastidious workbench, and had also installed a urinal in the far wall.
"For when inside's too far away," he explained.
He was sitting in a lawn chair in the garage when I arrived. He dipped into the cooler by his side and handed me a can of Busch and pointed at the empty chair next to him. He wore a shirt that said MAD at the top and Men Against Daughters Dating at the bottom. He was in his 60s, but still trim and with active gray eyes. His mustache was so thick it eclipsed his mouth.
"I was expecting a more impressive turnout," he said.
I said I was too. Norm told me he'd been living in Seldom Falls for 40 years, though I'd never seen him before.
"I'm tired of looking over my shoulder everywhere I go," he said, and I agreed.
He asked if I wouldn't mind taking minutes for the meeting. That way, when people joined later, they would be able to get up to speed more quickly. I had not intended to be the secretary, but I didn't seem to have a choice. Later, when I checked my notes, they said, "Meeting 1. Goals. Make neighborhood safe again. Methods. ? Recruitment. ? Next meeting. Order pizza." Calvin was due to arrive by the end of the next week. I told him again not to come, but he didn't answer. He had taken a leave of absence from work for what he called a family emergency. I needed to clean my house before he came, but I needed to do more than that. I needed to completely reorganize it, tear it down to the bones, and build a new home. I wanted him to see that I was fine. I wanted my fineness to be so overwhelming it suffocated us both.
"You've been wearing the same shirt for 4 days straight," Robbie said. as if I were somehow unaware of this fact.
It's pathetic.
You don't need to point these things out, I said. Not everybody is looking to be improved.
Robbie spit a mouthful of sunflower seeds into his cup.
You're just like a meteor of misery, you know? Like you just crash-landed here and there's a giant sad crater in my apartment.
It didn't seem like the right time to question his metaphor, so I got up and left his apartment.
Do meteors just walk away?
No, they do not. They burn up in the atmosphere, or they get chipped into pocket-sized pieces by collectors and sold on the internet. The next day, I told Robbie I was feeling lonely in this grim, sunless town. Loneliness has a volume, like any liquid. It fills you up and makes you heavier, and you try to dispel it through tears, but tears replenish themselves. Loneliness has a sound, like a bird calling for its lost mate. It reverberates and bounces off the walls, and every time it bounces back past you, it makes your world feel smaller and smaller until at night you are pressed down to the size of an atom and unable to escape. I told him I would rather live on the moon, or failing that, a different city where I knew nobody and would be free to try out a new persona, a more pleasant one, or maybe a less pleasant one, as long as it was different.
Don't know if I can make that kind of move right now, Robbie said,
and I realized he thought I was inviting him along with me. I held his hand and told him this is a me thing, not a me and you thing. I had to figure out where I was going. I did not tell him about Calvin's impending visit. On the moon, your body is 1/6 of its weight on Earth, but your regrets weigh the same. The weight of your past doesn't change. It's tempting to think about moving away from Earth and leaving everything behind, but it's not practical. How would you even breathe on the moon? What would you eat? An unmanned spaceship has landed on Mars and released 2 data-gathering robots. These robots would work in opposite directions, so the only moment they weren't alone on that planet was the few seconds before they began working. They were going to determine whether Mars was habitable. Nobody expected to find any aliens there, but I thought, what if the aliens have been avoiding us? We always assume they're out there plotting our deaths. But it seemed much more likely to me that they'd heard all about us and decided to stay as far away as possible. If you hear there's a shark in the water, you don't go swimming. If you know there's a planet full of beings with the ambition of destroying themselves, you just go to another planet. The aliens were waiting for us to kill ourselves off, so then they could move to our mostly functional planet. I began leaving my bedroom window open at night, hoping that if a UFO landed nearby, they would abduct me, take me back to wherever they'd come from. When Calvin showed up at my house, I was painting my toenails. I'd been painting my toenails, or pretending to, for a half hour. It seemed like the kind of casual, relaxed thing happy women do. It was a good thing to be seen doing. I wanted to look like a woman in a magazine advertisement. Later, I would eat salad and laugh at nothing. I would wear white pants and dance to a song only I could hear. A woman wearing comfortable clothing and sitting on her couch while she paints her toenails cannot be an unhappy woman. Calvin filled my entire doorway. I'd forgotten how big he was. When he was 13, he went through a growth spurt that nearly doubled him in size. I was happy for him then, because he would finally be able to defend himself. But if you give an angry boy too much strength, he's going to break things. He smiled and spread his arms wide, calling me toward him. Calvin liked hugs. Since he'd gotten sober, it was very important to him to make physical contact with people he loved.
Dr. Fogg had said he'd spent his whole life avoiding intimacy. We held on to each other for a long time, and I tried not to cry. But every time I saw my brother, I could not get over how healthy and happy he looked, and I wanted him to know I was proud of him. I did not know how to entertain a guest. What do most people do for fun? They look at the internet, or they look at the TV, or they masturbate, or they get drunk. You can do all of these things alone. I poured myself some wine and filled a glass of water for Calvin. He told me stories about going to the park with his wife and children. He talked about the great meal they'd had on Christmas. You can't spend the rest of your life projecting your unhappiness onto everyone else, he said. He'd learned a lot of slogans in rehab. Slogans sometimes save lives, but most often they lead to drunks thinking they're profound. Thank you for your feedback, I said. It's good to get feedback.
I want to see the school, he said.
I knew Calvin would be able to see the ghosts as well as I could. When his addiction was at its worst, I'd heard gossip about his fights and his accidents and his constant petty crimes. I knew my brother had died a dozen times and come back, and I'd never been able to help him. Before his first car wreck, he called me drunk and said,
I need to know somebody will miss me,
over and over again, until I said, yes, I will miss you. I knew the crash had been intentional, but the airbags had saved him. Some broken teeth, a shattered nose. Technology saves us even when we don't want it to. Someday in the future, robots will follow us like guardian angels, and nobody will ever die, even when we try to kill ourselves. I knew we would eventually go to the school together, but I felt I owed him some resistance. I felt a duty to shield him from something. Mayor Randy stationed police in SWAT gear throughout the township. He had also acquired 3 surveillance drones. They promised to increase security to levels that will stop all wrongdoing. But then they also promised not to inconvenience you. Somewhere in an office, there were 3 young people sitting behind computer screens and piloting tiny planes throughout the metro area to maintain a record of everything that was happening on the ground. The drones were unarmed, but they could summon security forces within minutes. They flew 18 hours a day. At first, people complained that they were intrusive, but soon they started to feel comforted by the distant buzz of a circling drone. The 6 droneless hours every day now felt suddenly more dangerous, because nobody was there to witness. Once you go out in public, you will have been recorded by somebody, and once your face is on a camera, it is saved forever. Your body is distilled and spread across too many spaces. People make fun of the Amish for not wanting their pictures taken, but maybe they were always right. The camera does steal your soul, a little bit at a time. Someone mailed a gun to a congresswoman with a handwritten note telling her to kill herself. She had recently delivered a speech arguing that private citizens should not have access to military-grade rifles. In response to the threat, police offered a $1,000 reward for information leading to the capture of the criminal. A man named Richard J. turned himself in, collected the cash, and then argued that arresting him for his letter was an infringement of his free speech rights. To some people, he was a hero. One of the news networks said he was a modern Patrick Henry. The next time I went to the post office, I had to have my package x-rayed and then fill out a form promising not to do anything illegal. Everyone agreed this was a reasonable solution to the problem of men mailing guns to women they didn't like. Calvin told me we were actually safer than ever. He showed me an article about the decrease in gun violence and another about lengthening lifespans. He showed me line graphs in descent. Murder rates were down across the country, violent crimes was at its lowest point in recorded history.
100 years ago, no woman would expect to be able to just walk around anywhere by herself and feel safe, he said. This is progress.
Statistics can say anything, I said.
There's too much information. That's the problem. You see everything and don't know how to sort it out. Only the terrible shit is memorable. But it's not all terrible.
But what's the point of all the numbers if I happen to be in the same room as the gun when it happens again?
Fuck, he said. The point is you won't be.
Men think confidence is a virtue, but confidence is the first thing that gets you killed. I ignored Robbie's texts while I walked around town with my brother. Robbie still did not know Calvin existed. The only thing he knew about my family was that my parents were dead, and that they'd had a bad marriage. As we walked down Main Street, Calvin waved to familiar faces, old high school classmates, store owners, men he'd known in a different life. Even if he'd wanted to hide, he couldn't, because he still had my father's face. Enough time spent on the wrong side of the law had trained him not to trust authority, and he especially hated the drones.
"Don't you feel like just climbing a wall and King-Konging some of these shitty things?" he said.
We'd been walking a half hour, through Main Street and down the side streets, deep into the mud flats, and soon we were near our old house. I don't think I led him there on purpose. I don't know who was leading. Calvin stopped talking, stopped smiling and joking as we neared our old block. He sat on the curb and lit a cigarette.
"Okay, all right. That's probably enough walking for the day," he said.
He looked pale and exhausted. The sickness doesn't leave you. It just takes new forms. While he lit another cigarette, I looked down the street toward the old house. I tried to see my mother and my father on the porch, but I couldn't see anything. Even when they were alive, they didn't sit together on the porch. When I was 15, we hosted everyone on my father's side of the family for the first ever Crawford family reunion. I have so many aunts and uncles and cousins that I have no idea who any of them are. Prior to that reunion, I'd never met most of them. And after it, despite all the promises to keep in touch and get together more often, we never saw them again. This was when I learned that my father had 2 brothers, rather than just one. I knew by then that he was the type of man who would hide the existence of people. I wondered if he'd ever told anyone about me. After the reunion, I asked him why he'd never mentioned his 2nd brother.
"I don't feel like I have to tell everyone everything," he'd said.
"Did you two get in a fight or something?"
"Anna, it's important for you to understand something. You think you know people, but you don't really know people."
I began spying on my father, expecting to find he led a secret double life. Maybe he was still having affairs, or he had a 2nd family. Maybe he seemed so exhausted all the time because he never slept. I skipped school and sneaked back into the basement and listened to him through the floor. But all he ever did was sit in the living room and watch TV. I woke up in the middle of the night, hoping to catch him sneaking out. But he was always in his bed. If he was living a double life, it was even more boring than the one he was escaping. His days of hiding and sneaking seemed long behind him. My mother's deli failed after 3 years because she gradually lost interest in it. Her obsessive work was derailed by sudden weekend jaunts where the family was meant to bond. We drove to Toronto and looked at the falls. While my father stood at the rail overlooking the water, my mother said to me, "He's thinking about jumping in." She laughed. "Your father is a suicide that hasn't happened yet." We went to Buffalo and to Cincinnati and to a cabin in the West Virginia mountains. I missed a lot of school. We didn't have enough money to get two hotel rooms, so my brother and I slept on a cot beside their bed. They thought I couldn't hear them, but it was all I could hear. My father rolling closer to her and pressing against her, his lips smacking on the back of her neck, until she sighed and rolled over, masturbating him under the covers. I started sleeping on the floor of the closet, but still I heard them. My mother was in the grip of some prolonged mania. Her love was aggressive and painful. We returned one Monday and found the deli in disrepair. She had forgotten to place food orders for the week and hadn't paid her employees, and so they had trashed the place. She sold it later to a man named Jensen. My mother returned to her original depressive state, and we watched her wither away in front of us. Every night, Calvin called his wife, and he told her things were going okay. He talked to his children. He told them he loved them. He was going to go home eventually because he actually did love them. Many fathers go home every day, and many mothers do too. Many families love one another, despite everything. Victims, Part 3. When Stuart W. was a freshman, he commandeered the school's PA system and announced he was the voice of God. "I have heard your prayers," he said, and began reeling off people's requests. He identified students petitioning God for a father to come home from Afghanistan, for a dog's heart condition to be healed, for an imaginary friend to come to life, for a volcano to rise up in the middle of town, for a pair of shoes made of gold. I thought it was an innocent prank. Then he said my name. "Miss Anna Crawford, I have heard your prayers every night, asking me to help you love yourself. This prayer and all the others I vow to fulfill," he said, before the mic suddenly cut out. He was suspended for 2 weeks. When he came back, I tried to stop him and ask him if he'd really heard me, but he avoided eye contact, and he walked slowly, stiffly. They say he was bleeding on the floor of the cafeteria for 3 hours before he died. I don't know if he even believed in prayer. Gilbert T. started teaching at the school 1 year after I did, and because I was the least tenured person on staff, I was assigned as his peer mentor. He was older than me, and had been teaching for 15 years already. When I showed him how to input grades in our computer system, he said, "Yes, I am aware of how grading works." In the faculty lounge, he would spread his newspaper across half the table and lean over it all morning, muttering to himself and counting out letters on his fingers. He was always working on the crossword, but I'd never seen him finish one. When he wasn't reading the paper, he was filling out promotional postcards. Once a week, he went to the big chain bookstore, rifled through all the magazines, and removed the inserts to apply for various sweepstakes and giveaways. He harvested 50 at a time. One day, I asked him how often he won. "I never send them in," he said. "What's the point with my luck?" Then he continued filling one out. I imagined a room in his house full of unsent sweepstakes entries. I wondered if the stack itself had any cash value. He wasn't killed in the shooting, but he couldn't walk, and he'd lost so much blood that his cognitive function was limited. He needed a full-time caretaker, and I knew he was thinking, it would have been luckier to just die. Neil V. was new at the school. His family had moved to town in February. On his first day in my class, he introduced himself by saying he used to live in Virginia, but then some stuff happened. He was chubby and sullen and slept through most classes. Some of the other teachers said his father was abusive and his mother had had to flee their home. They were in hiding. We weren't supposed to know, but of course we knew. Neil sat by himself in the mornings before school, lounging on the grass where the killings eventually happened, earbuds jammed into his ears and his eyes closed, his lips moving along with